Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, activism, and charities. My name is Ethan Clow, your host, as always, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. That's on your radio dial, as well as streaming live at CITR.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. Today is Friday the 13th, which, as you may guess, is a total coincidence. And of course, here on The Sector, as I mentioned, we discuss nonprofits, social justice, activism, politics, a little bit of everything in between. We have a great show today, lots to discuss. Of course, as a reminder, it's been 2 weeks since our last episode, and that's because we are on a brand new biweekly schedule here on The Sector. So, a new episode will come every second week, just to remind everybody. So if you tune in next week, we won't have a new episode. Week after, new episode. And this is actually episode 56 of The Sector. And as I mentioned, great show. We have lots of content to get to. Last week, or pardon me, see, I get it wrong. That's how why I keep reminding people. So 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the Liberal victory of Justin Trudeau's team, who was elected to a majority government here in Canada. And we sort of looked at some of the campaign promises by the Liberal Party, debating, discussing whether or not those campaign promises are likely to come about or whether or not they're kind of, you know, a bit of a crapshoot. Now, we're going to take a look at a few more today, but specifically, there's actually been some traction on a few of these campaign promises. So I wanted to kind of dive into those, discuss them a little bit, and we'll see, you know, where Trudeau is kind of leading us on this one. Now, again, as I mentioned those 2 weeks ago, because we're dealing with a majority government now, we don't really have a say in, you know, how this goes. And I suppose by saying, you know, we have a say, the Liberal Party no longer needs the support of the House of Commons. They have the House of Commons locked up. The interesting thing, of course, is going to be to see how the House and the Senate get along, because the Senate is now, I believe, majority is conservative senators elected by or appointed by Stephen Harper. So we'll have to see exactly how that plays out. Interestingly enough, the Conservatives have already elected an interim leader who's made some kind of interesting claims in the media. Again, you know, skepticism being the order of the day with that sort of thing. But aside from the political side of today's episode, it is also the week of Remembrance Day, which happened a few days ago on the 11th. So I hope you took some time at some point to remember or just have a quiet moment to reflect. You know, Remembrance Day is always an interesting thing. And in the past, both here on The Sector and in Radio Freethinker, I've discussed sort of my interpretation of Remembrance Day. And there's always a bit of an interesting conversation about that because it's not always universally accepted that it's a good thing. Remembrance Day, you know, especially in social justice circles. So I've always kind of like defended my interpretation of the event and talked a bit about some of the sort of anti-Remembrance Day sentiment that kind of crops up. I thought that maybe we'd take a break from that this year, and since there's not exactly anything new to say, you can always check out some of my past talks about this to, you know, get my perspective on that. And again, you'll find those in the show notes, so I won't bother you with that right now. One of the things that I usually do for Remembrance Day is I like to play a clip from the Blackadder TV series. For those of you who don't know, that's a TV series that went on for maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe a bit shorter, actually. Starring Rowan Atkinson, who was Mr. Bean, and he played sort of this cynical kind of jerk in various points of history throughout England's past. And one of the series was based on the First World War. And there's a very, very surprisingly poignant episode that ends up the series. And I've always liked that clip because it really kind of highlights, I think, both the tragicness that goes along with war, not just, you know, in general First World War history, but just in general, sort of the tragic side of it, But also, I think, kind of sums up the loss of innocence that can happen through war. And ultimately, I think the futility of the whole process. Now, I know I've aired it before, so I thought, well, maybe there's something different that I could air. And I actually recently saw an episode of Doctor Who that I think would actually be very fitting for this. So I'm going to play a clip from that. Just a reminder, or warning, I suppose. Potential spoilers, because this is from episode 8 of season 9. So if you haven't seen that episode and you want to go in totally fresh, maybe skip the ending of today's episode. I'll give fair warning when it's about to come up, and so you'll be able to pass it over and listen later. Anyway, so that's coming up here on The Sector. In addition, we may dive into some interesting questions about giving to nonprofits. So we'll see how things go, how the show develops, as always. And we'll be back with some more after we take our first little break here on The Sector. Stay tuned. It's going to be great.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag, all types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the top floor of the Student Union building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
Hello, we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. So, last week, we talked about the Liberal campaign promises. Well, this week, there has been some delivery on that front. The first bit of good news was that the Liberal government is reinstating the mandatory long-form census. This was, of course, scrapped by the Conservatives 5 years ago. And, I mean, anyone who has listened to past episodes of Radio Free Thinker, as well as this show, The Sector, will know that the long-form census has been a major sticking point for myself and other progressives. And you might say, well, why would you want to fill out that stupid long form? Well, actually, the reason is because this form provides really important, really valuable data across the Canadian population. This data goes on to inform everything from city ordinances and planning of how we lay out our neighborhoods, but also things like healthcare and figuring out what percentage of Canadians need X coverage of healthcare and where we have aging populations and where we have a trouble point when it comes to gaps in the system. That's just tip of the iceberg, really. There is a lot of information in there that really filters down to all the different levels of government and ultimately filters down through policymakers who work for the government, work for the city, work for healthcare, education. It also filters down into both the private sector, focusing on things like service. So, for instance, telephone companies and cable providers and whatnot use that information to better serve the customer base because they learn more about where customers are and what their needs are and et cetera, et cetera. talking about the nonprofit side of things, that information is often used to determine what should the nonprofit focus on. Where is there the greatest need? If their mandate involves a specific group of people, for example, immigrants or maybe the underprivileged or poverty-stricken parts of Canada, et cetera, the long-form census is able to give us a very good snapshot of where those points are, and useful, like really useful data on what those groups of people, you know, actually need in terms of service. So it has a huge impact all across the board. And so for some people, they look at it and they think it's just a waste of time. But in reality, this provides just a wealth of important information that is really valuable to know, not just from a point of view of planning and policy. But this is also really important data for the role of academia. It's really important for, you know, sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, all of those, you know, soft sciences, if you want to call them that, depend on accurate data to not just do research and write books and all that kind of stuff, but for purposes of education, making sure that we're able to accurately explain to, you know, new students and people who are studying these things, this is how things look in Canada. It really makes a difference. Now, what's good about this news is that the Minister of Innovation, Science and Economics, Navdeep Bains, made the announcement on Parliament Hill, quote, "We need good, reliable data." And that is kind of what I just said, so kudos to him for summing it up. But also, it definitely indicates a very big shift in terms of how our government views information and views the use of facts, science, and figures to back up policy. Now, that point, that issue of forming your policy and governing based on facts, figures, and data, that really needs to be highlighted, I think. Because again, if you're governing based on ideology, then facts and figures, well, they don't matter. I mean, you're just making decisions based on preconceived notions of whatever. I mean, whether it's tradition, whether it's religion, whether it's, you know, decades old research that you're just not going to update, that's not really a good way to, you know, provide for Canadians when it comes to things like healthcare and science and the environment and blah, blah, blah. So this is a very important shift and we should note it. And again, like a good example of this is a harm reduction drug policy. We've talked about this a lot on the show. When the government tried to shut down Insight, they were arguing from the point of view of ideology, that they had a ideological opposition to the very concept of harm reduction. And that ideology went completely counter to the scientific evidence that was coming in. And the courts ultimately ruled that the scientific evidence is far more pressing and ultimately more important to the long-term health of Canadians than an ideological objection to a policy that is proven to work. And that's what the long-form census, in a nutshell, represents. Now, speaking of access to data, another big change that's already happened under Trudeau is the demuzzling, or unmuzzling, I don't know how you say that actually, whatever, the removal of the muzzle on scientists throughout Canada. Now, this story goes back to when the Harper government basically shut down scientists across Canada in an effort to keep important information held tightly to the government's chest and not allowed to gain access to media. This had major implications for, like, let's just count them off. So first of all, scientific literacy was damaged by this because the public was not getting clear, unfettered access to the nation's scientists who were working on important issues. Number two, it really hampered media in their efforts to get the story out to people, the public, about, you know, what's happening, scientifically speaking, in Canada. That information was repressed. And ultimately, it prevented scientists from raising the alarm about important environmental issues, health issues, basically anything that might be happening to which a scientist needs to raise awareness of. You know, kind of a broad scope of things, but nonetheless, equally important. Now, you know, why would anybody want to repress science in that way? And again, it goes back to our previous point. The conservatives did not want facts, figures, data, evidence, to get in the way of an ideological-based agenda. And this actually comes from not just scientists who are very happy to be able to speak up again, but this is coming from not just the public and private sectors, it's coming from media itself. Many of the articles that are talking about this have mentioned how media relations people for work for reported newspapers, radio stations, etc., are just so happy that they're able to send a request to a minister or to a department and actually get a reply within a few hours. I mean, it is remarkable how much happier it is to be able to do your job without having some kind of government clampdown reign over you. The scientists in question are overjoyed that this, quote, reign of terror is ending. Stephen Campana, who is a former senior scientist at Fisheries and Oceans Canada, was quoted as saying, "It was toxic. It's the only word I can use to describe it. It was like telling a medical doctor, sit down in the corridor, shut up, and don't do anything." So, you know, a pretty damning condemnation of a policy that saw Canada's media outlets deprived of science for so long. Now, in addition to allowing scientists to once again talk about their research to the public without seeking prior approval through some government bureaucrat, many are hoping that this will signal a return to actually funding science. Again, one of the problems with Stephen Harper was that he defunded many scientific endeavors and projects, particularly focusing on the environment. And again, you know, you wonder why somebody would want to do that, since the environmental sciences are vitally important for Canada's future. It was to prevent that kind of information from getting in the way of an ideological viewpoint that, you know, A, climate change is not happening, or B, if climate change is happening, then it's not human caused and it's certainly going to be a problem to be worried about, blah, 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 blah. Now we actually have a situation where scientists can again say, listen, this policy is not addressing a important environmental issue, and indeed, we should have funding in place to make sure that we're able to research as well as prepare for potential catastrophes related to the climate, related to the environment. What's really remarkable about the lift of the muzzle from government scientists is that they are actually, not only are they being allowed to speak with media without contacting a government bureaucrat, they're actually being encouraged to get back to their media contacts quickly. As a good example of this is an article in the CBC talking about this very subject, where a researcher, Christy Miller, who works with the Fisheries and Oceans Canada, was shocked when in 2011 she was prevented from discussing her research into the 2009 Fraser River sockeye salmon collapse. I mean, like, if you think about it, like, this is an important, this is not necessarily going to inform, like, government policy. Her talking to Science Magazine, it's just being ridiculous that the government is saying, no, no, you can't talk to them, because why? Like, what, is Science Magazine going to get suddenly picked off the shelves by people and there's going to be riots and outrage? No, it was just a way to silence any kind of environmental-based science that would put any kind of negative light on the conservatives' ideological assault on the environment. So already we see a couple big changes under the Trudeau government. Again, is, yes, following up with campaign promises. We'll have to keep a close eye on, you know, how this develops. Does Trudeau continue this process of living up to his campaign promises? Or, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, you know, there are certain issues that we may not see the progress that was promised. Now, ultimately, where that takes us remains to be seen. I think that given the fact that Trudeau recently unveiled his new cabinet, has indicated that he tends to call back Parliament within a few weeks, so we'll find out pretty quickly what the agenda is for the Trudeau government. And, you know, who knows? Maybe he will live up to those promises. But again, I think that we, you know, as a voting bloc, as a popular voting bloc, we need to make sure that Trudeau is held accountable. And we need to make sure that his new cabinet, and as well as the new MPs, are all aware that people expect him to live up to those promises. He's got a lot of damage to undo. Let's face facts, right? Harper changed Canada to great degrees, and undoing that damage, repairing that damage, is going to take a long time. In some cases, Trudeau may undo the damage, but he may not repair the damage, and that's an important distinction. Anyway, why don't we take another quick break here on The Sector? We will return after this. Stay tuned.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
We are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting, of course, on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, before we get on with more show content, I wanted to take a quick musical interlude, and we do this every now and then. We'll just play a bit of music. It's, you know, radio station and music, it all kind of goes together. So today I'm just going to play for you a track off of David Bowie's most recent album, The Next Day. And this track is entitled I'll Take You There. So let's go to that right now.
Hold my hand and I'll take you there. Who will
And that was I'll Take You There by David Bowie. You may have heard of him. Off his most recent studio album, The Next Day, I think he released a different one after that, but it wasn't like a new material. It was just like a best of some kind. And I think recently he announced he's got a new one coming out. So interesting stuff. People just keep on rocking, don't they? Anyway, getting on with today's show, as I said, lots of content to get to. But first, just a quick announcement, as this is the Sector podcast, you may have noticed the podcast part. We broadcast, of course, on CITR 101.9 FM Friday mornings at 8 a.m., as well as we stream live at CITR.ca. But if you want to download the podcast, you can do so at CITR as well. Just search The Sector on a CITR search function, and you will find our page as well as a whole host of episodes that you can download the past podcast for. You can also go to sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can find all of our show notes. So if you want to do any checking, if you want to see what we're talking about, do some background checks on me and everything else, you are welcome to do so. And again, that is sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, if you are online, you might as well like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as follow us on Twitter. You can follow me at Ethan Clow or at Sector Podcast. And today's show, we still have lots of content to get to. Well, getting back to the question of nonprofit discussion, nonprofits and charities, actually. There's been a recent article, a pair of articles actually, that have been circulating in the nonprofits environment, social circles, networks, whatnot, that I wanted to give a bit of attention to. The first one appeared in The Atlantic, which is a kind of news serial from the U.S., entitled Give Poor People Cash. And it provoked an interesting level of conversation and proposed a kind of, some might argue, controversial point about how to direct cash to best serve, in this case, poor people, but it could also be kind of any kind of social issue, really. And ultimately raised the question, is a nonprofit actually doing any good through this process? You know, is a nonprofit kind of acting like a middleman? You know, the public gives the nonprofit money. The nonprofit takes the money, utilizes it in some way, and then give service to the target group demographic cause. Is that the most efficient system? This article in The Atlantic argues that no, and it brings up a few very interesting points that I want to kind of quickly summarize. And again, for those paying attention, this article and its rebuttal will appear online on our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And I encourage you to take a look and give them a thorough read, as they're quite interesting. But let's kind of give the Cole's Notes version of this. Now, the article written by Charles Kinney makes an interesting case that in order to best help, you know, your given demographic, giving them direct money, despite the general kind of rejection by U.S. politicians and policymakers in general throughout the U.S., actually has a very good track record in improving lives. According to the argument of the article, when a government tries to give people something in lieu of cash, like food, it frequently costs more to deliver that support than it would to distribute the cash itself. In some cases, having even a less than direct impact as opposed to just giving somebody the food they need to go and buy some food. Now, there's been some studies on this that have looked at whether or not just giving straight up cash actually has a better advantage. And, you know, what they found was both interesting and, of course, I think a little bit obvious. In one sense, the kind of standard argument against this is that people will just go and buy tobacco or alcohol or whatever. It turns out that no, the evidence does not support that. In fact, people who receive cash experience the same improvements in nutrition and child health care measures that those who got food would have. Food programs tend to cost about 20% more to administer, and the cash programs generally led to a significantly higher non-food consumption by recipients. So in other words, less cost, cash programs led to the same health outcomes. Now, there are some caveats, obviously, with that. This is an American study, and it's obviously coming from somebody who, well, I guess I shouldn't say obviously, but it's this sort of political viewpoint of charity and cash is a fairly politicized issue in terms of social safety nets and kind of long-term benefits of having a social safety net. There are additional factors here that go into this question, aside from simply the question of what is going to have the greater net result, giving direct cash or providing a system in place to provide service. So let's, you know, we're not necessarily measuring that. We're just kind of talking about it on a very kind of binary level. But that being said, there are some promising things that are coming out of direct cash transfers. For instance, if you give somebody cash, they're able to spend it locally. So not only do they help feed themselves, but they're also able to provide patronage to local farmers, local growers, and that helps stimulate the local economy. As opposed to just giving somebody food, that consumption just ends as soon as that food is consumed. There's not a lot of carry-on benefit. Additionally, when the cash is not earmarked for certain things, people are able to spend it to get food, but they're also able to spend it on things like paying off their debt, paying off their loans, school, mortgages, and whatnot. And again, it's that sort of kick-on effect, right? If you can hammer off a few of those things and still be fed, well, you're going to be better off in the long run, aren't you? I mean, you're freeing up yourself from stress and from, you know, all kinds of things. So there's definitely some knock-on effects of giving direct cash to people that isn't earmarked for something. One of the side effects, of course, of giving direct cash that has no earmark is that people are often free to use it in a way that would not necessarily be anticipated by service providers. So for instance, if you're giving cash to someone who lives in a different country, they know locally, you know, where they need to spend that money, as opposed to someone, you know, donating it here in Canada or the US. So someone in Africa may decide that instead of, you know, buying a bunch of food immediately, the best course of action is to buy a goat or to replace their roof or whatever it is that they do. Those can have knock-on effects. They can maybe buy a better food storage device so that they're able to have food longer, and that could impact, you know, their long-term survivability much more than going out and buying a sandwich. So there's definitely a side to this that is very interesting and really indicates that there's lots of potential for cash transfers in lieu of like a donation to a charity. So then, does this mean that charities are in fact just kind of an inefficient middleman? And indeed, like, some people have specifically made this argument. In fact, one of the things that I've heard a lot, not just sort of in my own kind of social circles, but amongst other kind of like-minded progressive individuals who do want to give back to the community, that many of them are actually buying into this notion that it's far more efficient and ultimately more beneficial to not bother with a nonprofit or a charity, but instead direct your energy through this kind of direct to the source investments. And there's different kinds. Like, this is the ones that I've given here are more about food, but there are other examples of this related to healthcare and other factors. And it has generated a lot of controversy and discussion. But does it mean that a nonprofit is ultimately obsolete? Well, not necessarily. In fact, almost assuredly, no. In fact, nonprofits are still very needed. To dive into this particular issue, there was kind of a rebuttal piece that was published in The Conversation, which is also sort of a news serial magazine online, discussion paper. Anyway, I'll again add this to our show notes, and you can take a look at it as well. This post is titled "Why the World Still Needs Nonprofits," and it is written by Michael Jones. The article that Jones writes touches on a lot of the things that, you know, we've discussed here on The Sector in terms of frustration regarding the nonprofit sector. People want to make sure that their cash donations are going into service, so not covering things like overhead or you know, the pay factor for the employees, or all of those things. And again, like, never mind the fact that we've kind of debunked that a little bit here on the show. We've also kind of talked about why that actually is very important. A very important aspect of the nonprofit community is, you know, actually paying the people who do the work. But setting aside that for a moment, Jones points out that we shouldn't be too quick to dismiss the value of a nonprofit. One of the obvious reasons, of course, is that nonprofits generally are staffed by experienced personnel who not just know the region or the cause that they're supporting, but usually have a lot of experience in the sector that allows them to administrate and provide in really important ways. This is something that often gets overlooked. It's one thing to have a great cause and be able to funnel money to a source. It's quite another to be able to manage that and to manage that transfer of money to make sure that it happens, you know, both legally and ethically, but also that it is being utilized in the best way possible. And again, this is not necessarily going to be totally relevant for simply buying food, but it's very important for anything from disaster relief to relief of poverty, say here locally in Canada, all the way over to environmental charities that are focusing on where best to address advocacy issues and where to direct political pressure to get something changed, that sort of thing. However, Jones does make a pretty good point, one that we often kind of assume that the whole boots on the ground thing is actually really expensive, but it's nonprofits are really good at managing that cost, so it's a lot cheaper than the average person would expect it to be. Again, according to this article, and again, this is probably a U.S. Fact, but one in four nonprofits have 12% or less in overhead costs. Additionally, the overall average for a nonprofit is about 20%, and even that is really good. 20% is pretty amazing when you think that is covering the staff, the fundraisers, the location, the venue, the resources that they need to do their job. All of those things packaged together is only 20%. That's really good. But, I mean, even if you're skeptical about that number, it's also important to remember, as Jones points out in this article, that there are many ways that nonprofits are able to multiply the donations that they get in and various factors. So one thing, again, going back to that question of experience, nonprofits are very adept at identifying where they need to address a problem, where they need to direct funds. And a lot of times this process is not something that the average person would recognize. It's not like they're walking down the street with a clipboard going, oh, there's a broken faucet right there, and oh, that window's smashed, and oh, look, that car's been turned over. They don't do that, right? Like, they actually do interact with their clients. They do interact with their target demographics in ways that most of us don't get an opportunity to. They're often able to go into areas that you might consider, like, hidden. And again, like, a good example of this would be, like, a shelter, a place where you know, maybe battered women would go, and, you know, you're not just able to walk into this place and be like, oh, I see exactly where the need is, here's some money. You know, you need to be a professional. You need to be trained to handle people who are going through trauma. And again, same with addiction services and the environment as well. I mean, obviously we can't, like, walk into a swamp somewhere and go, oh, you know, that frog needs help, right? So nonprofits are able to multiply that through their expertise. Another key point that Jones makes, and I think this is actually something that often gets shortchanged in discussions about charities, is that education can sometimes be more valuable than money. And this is maybe a bit counterintuitive or a bit unpopular, but the idea that just giving somebody cash can solve their poverty-related problems is not always 100% accurate. Education can play a major role in giving somebody a skill set so that they can move out of the poverty area. He uses a really good example of professional football players who are going to make way more money than somebody with a college degree in America. However, about 78% of professional football players go broke after 2 years of retirement. And a lot of times it's because they don't have the financial training or background to manage their wealth. So again, education can play a major role. And this is likewise applicable to like a health charity, right? We can think of things in terms of like day-to-day healthcare can play a major role in helping someone deal with trauma or, you know, deal with poverty or whatnot. It's that kind of maintenance side of the nonprofit's mandate that has the impact there. Now, I won't go over point by point everything that Jones makes, but again, like, there's a couple things here that probably I should mention just quickly. One of them is providing service after the initial donation. So this is really important, especially for healthcare and poverty relief, but charities are able to check in with people. You know, after somebody goes through a service provided by a nonprofit, they usually leave, but then the nonprofit is able to check in with them every now and then and say, hey, it's been 6 months, how are you doing? And that check-in is really important in the recovery process for not just health and poverty, but so many different other ways. And again, that's part of the donation. That's part of what you're giving to. And that ability to maintain contact with the person you're serving. Of course, nonprofits have the other great advantages that they're able to evaluate the process. They're able to look back and say, okay, what did we accomplish? How did we do it? What could be made better and faster and ultimately more effective? You can't really do that if the only interaction you have is just giving pure cash. You can't like look back and say, could I have given it in a different way? The only way to give it is the way that you gave it. So a nonprofit, again, has that ability to evaluate and then, based on that evaluation, change. So a nonprofit could say, okay, well, we've looked at the situation and we realized that we need to redirect advocacy to a certain aspect of the conversation. They're able to pivot like that and then focus it there. That's a process that for an individual donor, you can't really do. Again, you can only just give directly. You don't have the ability to get feedback, and you don't have the ability to ultimately do anything else except just give more money. And in some cases, sure, that works great. But in other cases, you're not getting the added benefit of relying on the experience of policymakers who do this professionally. So again, like, a lot of content here, I think, is worth reading. And I don't want to go over it point by point, but again, it does bring up some very interesting questions. And I think perhaps for future episodes, we'll dive into this again, hopefully with some experts in the field who can give us their own perspective on this one. In the meantime, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We'll return with our Doctor Who clip talking about Remembrance Day. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this. Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, your host, talking about nonprofit social justice and activism, all that great stuff. Anyway, I started the show, I talked a bit about Remembrance Day, and how I used to play a Blackadder clip that I thought, you know, kind of gave Remembrance Day a lot of poignancy and also a way to experience it and understand what the purpose behind it is. Well, In a recent episode of Doctor Who, there was a very interesting speech on war that, you know, I really felt spoke to kind of the spirit behind Remembrance Day and the point about the futility of war, the unpleasant aspect of war, and ultimately why remembering the cost is so important. So I want to play that clip for you right now. It's about 5 minutes long. Just a bit of a warning again. If you haven't seen this episode, it's from season 9, episode 8. So if you haven't caught yourself up on Doctor Who, you can just tune out right now. We're going to play the episode or play the clip, and then we'll do our close out here on the show. So you could fast forward if you want. So just spoiler warning, season 9, episode 8. Here is a clip from that episode of Doctor Who.
And we're off! Fingers on buzzers! Are you feeling lucky? Are you ready to play the game? Who's going to be quickest? Who's going to be luckiest?
This is not a game!
No, it's not a game, sweetheart, and I mean that most sincerely.
Why are you doing this?
Yes, I'd quite like to know that, too. You set this up. Why?
Because it's not a game, Kate. This is a scale model of war. Every war ever fought right there in front of you. Because it's always the same. When you fire that first shot, no matter how right you feel, you have no idea who's going to die. You don't know whose children are going to scream and burn. How many hearts will be broken? How many lives shattered? How much blood will spill until everybody does what they were always going to have to do from the very beginning? Sit down and talk! Listen to me, listen. I just want you to think. Do you know what thinking is? It's just a fancy word for changing your mind.
I will not change my mind.
Then you will die stupid. Alternatively, you could step away from that box. You could walk right out of that door and you could stand your revolution down.
No. I'm not stopping this, Doctor. I started it. I will not stop it. You think they'll let me go after what I've done?
You're all the same, you screaming kids. You know that? Look at me. I'm unforgivable. Well, here's the unforeseeable. I forgive you. After all you've done, I forgive you.
You don't understand. You will never understand.
I don't understand. Are you kidding? Me? Of course I understand. I mean, do you call this a war, this funny little thing? This is not a war. I fought in a bigger war than you will ever know. I did worse things than you could ever imagine. And when I close my eyes, I hear more screams than anyone could ever be able to count. And you know what you do with all that pain? Shall I tell you where you put it? You hold it tight. Till it burns your hand. And you say this. No one else will ever have to live like this. No one else will ever have to feel this pain. Not on my watch.
It's empty, isn't it? Both boxes. There's nothing in them. Just buttons.
Of course. Do you know how you know that? Because you've started to think. It's hell, isn't it?
No one should have to think like that. And no one will. Not on our watch.
How can you be so sure?
Because you're of a disadvantage, Sajila. I know that face.
This is all very well, but we know the boxes are empty now. We can't forget that.
No, well, you said that the last 15 times.
And we're back here on The Sector. That was a clip from Doctor Who, Season 9, Episode 8, and the brilliant Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. So I encourage you to check out that episode and have a look at it, and hopefully you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Anyway, we're running out of time here on The Sector, so it's time to sign off. And once again, I want to thank you all for tuning in or downloading the podcast and listening whenever, wherever. Remember, if you haven't already, to find us on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as on Twitter. You can find me at Ethan Clow, and I will be happy to tweet at you all day long. And visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can download our show notes as well as get our podcast. And of course, listening online at citr.ca, and tune into the radio every once in a while, because it, you know, those radio dials, they need a bit of love. The next episode of The Sector will be in 2 weeks' time, so goodness, when will that be? Which, 27th of November, so I'm looking forward to seeing you then, 8 o'clock in the morning, and anytime via podcast. In the meantime, have a fantastic weekend, and I hope your Remembrance Day went well. We will see you all in 2 weeks' time, so have a great week to go with that as well. And then we will see you again next Friday here on CITR, with a new episode of The Sector. Until then, this is Ethan Clow, your host, saying thank you so much for tuning in. We will see you all again very soon. Goodbye, everybody.
Unconditional love.
Verde, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.